Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Eidetopod, the first extended interview of the season. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Eidetopod is a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM. And as the 33 teams are out there mushing the first couple hundred miles of trail today, it's Monday from where I'm sitting, we're working on another full episode of the Eidetopod. For now, though, we have a chat from before the race between our trail reporter Lex Trinan and defending Iditarod champ Brent Sass. The 43-year-old Mushers team faced off with five-time champion Dallas Seavey last year, claiming the victory in a nail-biting finish by just over an hour after 8 days of racing. Sass has continued to compete in mid-distance races this year, some with younger dogs, and in the 550-mile Yukon Quest at the beginning of February, Sass brought his A-team of mostly veteran dogs from his Iditarod win last year and cruised to an easy victory over some other top-tier competitors. A couple days after that win, Sass sat down with our guy Lex to talk about his hectic life at his homestead north of Fairbanks in Eureka and about his newfound confidence going into this year's Iditarod, as well as his philosophy about dog mushing. Here is Brent Sass talking to Lex Trinan.
All right. Well, let's get this started. I'm here with Brent Sass, 2023 Quest 550 champion. I heard you had a wild last couple days getting back to your homestead. Can you talk about what you were doing and what happened?
Yeah. We all had to rush back right after the finish of the 550 because Iditarod food drops due on Monday, and they were not complete yet. So I had to get back, and I decided to drive through the night to get home, and then I had a broken down snow machine when I got there. So
you got to the parking lot, and you leave a snow machine there, and it was...
Yeah, it was froze up. It was like 25 below and blowing 20 miles an hour, so there was no hope. So my handlers are all sleeping. It was like 3:30 in the morning. So again, like I'd been doing for the last 5 days, I slept in the truck.
You were driving the truck, though? Your handlers didn't do that?
No, it was all me. No, those guys are all my handlers are like my friends, so they all went back to their normal lives, and I headed back home with the dogs.
Oh, so you were by yourself?
I was by myself.
Okay, sorry, yeah. I misunderstood.
Yeah, I was by myself. So yeah, I just slept in the truck, and my handler that stayed back at home was at the kennel, and in the morning they came out with the heaters and all the stuff to try and get the machine going, and got it running and made it in, and you know, started going at the food drops right off the bat. So
you got that all taken care of, and you get some sleep?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I've gotten like probably 5 hours of sleep, you know, since you know, one good night since the race. But it's a huge check, you know. The food drop is a huge deal for the Iditarod, and when you get to that point where you get to seal those bags up and be like, see ya, it means like now it's like we can relax a little bit leading up to the race. All the gear and supplies are going to be out on the trail. Your strategy is already out on the trail, so in the end, it takes a lot of pressure off. It's nice that you have to turn them in a couple weeks before the race, because now once you do that, I think for me the stress is way down, and I get to focus on the dogs and get the last bit of training done and not have to worry about so many logistical things. All the extra paperwork for the Iditarod is due on food drop day, and I have all that in for the first time in my life, so that's really good. We're ready to rock and roll.
Right on. So can you talk a little bit about the Quest and like kind of how it relates to the Iditarod? I mean, what did you learn about your dogs? Anything new this year?
Yeah. Oh man, the 550 was awesome. You know, it was a perfect distance for... I mean, I never want to call the Quest a warm-up to the Iditarod because it's its own race, and this was an epic race, and I hope we can continue this race in the future. But it is a really good warm-up and a really good test for the dogs. I had three tester dogs in this team, some two-year-olds and then a three-year-old, that weren't in my Iditarod team last year. And two of them did excellent, and I think are probably going to make the team. And, you know, at any time you can put the dogs through a race like that, a very challenging, difficult race with that sort of distance, basically it's like it gets us to our 24 in the Iditarod. And so that really gives you a real close look at what the dogs are going to look like coming into your 24. And any little nicks and dings that may be lying in the dog somewhere is going to come out. And so I got really lucky. I had 12 hard-pulling, healthy dogs at the end, and that was, you know, that's what we were looking for. And the two that I dropped are fine and healed up, but they won't be in the Iditarod. So that's we learned a lot, and the dogs were just, yeah, they were spot on. I was very impressed with their performance.
And you have quite a few veterans now on your team, right? Like, or like I mean, not only Iditarod veterans, but they're also, you know, 7 years old, something like that. Can you talk about just like having the mix of different dogs? How does that play into it?
Yeah, it's great. You know, the having the young dogs be able to run with these older ones. I mean, that's what I did all season. You know, I did 5 other races. This was the 5th race of the season. I did Iditarod be the 6th race. And the whole goal for the season was to mix the teams up and give some young dogs a chance to run with those veterans and see how they did. Because just like anything, if you stick a young dog with an old dog, they're going to learn a lot and they're also going to rise to the occasion. Any of the good ones are going to rise to the occasion. You run a 2-year-old and a whole group of 2-year-olds, you can't really see their potential. You know, you stick a 3 or 4 or 5 two-year-olds in with a whole team of veterans, their maturity level just innately goes up, I feel like. And so I was able to see a lot of that in both the Copper Basin. I had 3 testers. The K300 was primarily a younger team. And I learned a lot about those dogs. And 2 of those dogs are now 15 and 16 for the Iditarod. So they're trying out for the team. I haven't totally decided the team yet. So I've still got 3 young dogs that are fighting for like that last spot in the Iditarod team. So it's exciting.
Okay. And then you mentioned Slater. You said maybe the best sled dog you'll ever drive. Can you talk about what makes a sled dog have those qualities?
It's their head. I think mainly it's just their mental ability, the ability to just put their head down and go whenever you ask them to go. And I mean, Slater gained weight during the Quest 550. I mean, Nina at the last checkpoint was like, I'm pretty sure he's like a 5 and started as a 4, which is, you know, 4 is kind of fat to begin with, and he's finished the race a little even fatter. So that type of thing, that means his metabolism is functioning fully and they're just really ready to go. But with Slater, you know, it's the bonding connection I have with him. I think that it's just deeper. It's just like his dad, or his grandpa, Silver, was my original big furry sled dog that kind of got the whole kennel started, which is his grandpa. And he carries that same sort of loyalty. And it's a dog that'll just never stop. And you ask him to get up and go off that straw, and I don't have any doubt that he's just going to jump up and go do that job. I mean, he led the entire way in the Connect 200. He led the entire way in the Copper Basin 300, and he just led the entire way in the Quest 550. And I don't usually do that, but I feel like this is probably his last year of being that top dog. He's 7, going to be 8 here in April. So he might be in the team next year if he, you know, we'll see how his longevity is. But I don't feel like I'm going to be able to just lean on him as much as I can this year. So I'm having the time of my life with him and utilizing all of his skills. And then I was able to put 3 different leaders in lead with him during the 550, ones that are coming up the ranks, Ace and Katuk and his brother Pink. I guess they're the same age, but Ace and Katuk are kind of up-and-coming leaders, and have them running next to an experienced leader like that is super helpful and gives them a big step up for the future.
And you talked about this a little bit last year with us when we interviewed you post-Iditarod, and just sort of the way that you like to have your dogs. You know, I think you compared it to having a family, and I mean, I know a lot of your dogs are family with one another, but also, you know, you bring them inside. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that philosophy? Like, you know, how does that change the way a dog team works together and looks at you and all that?
I mean, I think that this sport is all about the connection you have with your dogs. And the more time you spend with the dogs, the more love and care and attention you give to them, the more they're going to give to you. And so I've based my entire career on the fact of, they live in the cabin. Last night I had all 16 of them in the cabin, and they'll be staying in the cabin most nights here up and leading up to Iditarod, because it's a time to bond, and it's a time to just hang out and just being present with them as much as possible. I think it's something that's super important. And, you know, after the effort they gave in the 550, I mean, they love coming inside and laying on the carpet, and they've all been doing it since puppies. It's not something that you just like do on the special treat. Like, these dogs, I've raised every single dog in this team from a puppy, and they've been coming inside with me. And like, I had 4 of Slater's kids that are puppies this year that were living in the cabin with me, you know, during the season, just to get them start that bond early. And so that is, I think it's a huge part of our success is making it a family affair, both inside of the dog team, all of them being related, and it helps me interact with them and helps me understand them better, because we're all just like our family members, right? Our brothers and sisters, and there's a lot of similarities between all of us as humans, and it's the same way with the dogs. And so if you can get to know what those traits and characteristics of the dogs are, you can go generations and understand the dogs better before you even understand them, before they even get old enough to really understand them. So I feel like that connection that we have is big. And you have to have a certain lifestyle. I mean, when you have 16 dogs in the cabin, you have to really love it, because it's not for everybody, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Have you talked to any other mushers that
Oh, there's that definitely people that do it. I'm not going to say I'm the only one by far, but I feel like it's an anomaly. I think there's a lot less people, and people might bring one or two or three in. I think that happens a lot, but to bring like your entire team in, and I don't do it a ton like during the normal season, because it's in the middle of the season and I need their coats to grow properly and all that. And I'll bring one or two or three in throughout the season. But when it gets to this time during race season, like pre and post races, they spend a lot of time inside with me. And
you're not spending too much time cleaning up their dog poop?
No. They have very, very few accidents inside. And, I mean, my cabin is all penned in. So, you know, you have to let them out. It's part of, like, the sleep deprivation. Like, I have to get up every 4 or 5 hours and like, open the door, and the whole parade crams out the door, and they go out and they go to the bathroom and do their thing. Open the door and they all come running right back in. So if I didn't do that, I'd probably have problems. But they're also, just because I do it from puppies, they're just like a house dog. A house dog will hold its bathroom break as long as it needs to, because they're used to it and they know how to do it. And I mean, I would say that my sled dogs are like house dogs on that front.
Yeah. You said you kind of run off 5 hours of sleep a night. That's a good night for you. Is that right? And
oh yeah, I mean,
have you always been like that?
The last 20 years probably, but yeah, 4 to 5. If I get 4 hours of sleep during the season a night, that's a win.
I mean, a lot of people would think that's insane. Where do you think that energy comes from?
The passion that I have for this sport and my lifestyle, and I mean, I don't have a choice, because there's too many things to do, and you know, and a lot of it is the lifestyle I've chosen out in Eureka, and being away from town and having a homestead to keep up and keep going, and generators to fix, and we're creating our own power, and we're, you know, hauling everything in from Fairbanks. So it's you know, that part of it takes a lot of sleep away, because that's an extra effort that if you live in town and live on the grid and everything, you don't have all of those extra chores to do. But you have distraction. You have friends. You have bars to go to, and you have all that. So I trade, you know, being social and going to the bar and going to events and all that for – fixing generators and snow machines and hauling things in and out. Like last night, you know, we got done with our food drops, and it's not done. Once you get them all done, then you load them onto a snow machine sled, and you got to haul them out to the road, where then you load them into a truck, and then they come to Fairbanks. So there's an extra step for everything when you're living out there.
Is there either a physical or, I don't know, emotional, psychological toll of just like charging so hard all the time in your life that takes, like, how long do you think you can do that for?
We'll see. I mean, it definitely is. And I crash. I mean, I'm going to crash, you know. I mean, I'm definitely, like, that's what I said, like, getting this food drop done, it's a big moment. Like, now the pressure's kind of off. I got a couple more bigger runs I want to do with the dogs, but I'm going to sleep a lot more in the next month or 3 weeks leading up to the Iditarod, for sure, just to sort of get my body at the most highest, you know, performance I possibly can, because I'm like anybody else. So you're going to wear out eventually. But I do feel like it's the passion that just drives me, and genetics. My dad is 70 years old and going crazy. Everybody knows my dad out on the trail.
Yeah,
we've all seen him doing it. So, I mean, I think a lot of it is genetics as well. Just like with the dogs, there's some genetics that can handle the races and do really well in them. I think in humans, it's the same way. I mean, I think that my body and my genetics are just designed to be able to do something like this. And I've been able to find my passion.
And do you have any, like, lingering, I don't know, physical injuries? I imagine the sport beats you up.
It does. I've been, knock on wood, I've been very lucky. I'm a pretty healthy person. I try and eat as best I can. I don't always do well at that, but I've gotten better over the years at taking care of my body, I think, and knowing when I need to do something different. But I'm active all the time, and I feel like what causes people to have problems is being stagnant and not being able to move around all the time. You know, like, I mean, I look around at some of my closest friends, and they just had an office job for the last 20 years, you know, and for me, I I don't sit down very often. And because of that, I feel like I've stayed in really good physical fitness. And I mean, I don't get me wrong. When I woke up the morning after the race, I was a hurting unit, you know, like there was some aches and pains and I was like, oh man, I feel like I'm getting a little bit older, I think. But that being said, because I have such the stamina, you know, it just takes a little bit of waking up and a little bit more sleep after the race, and I feel like I bounce back pretty fast.
Gotcha. I asked you about this in our pre-race interview, but I don't know if I got the full answer, but, you know, you won the Iditarod last March. Congratulations again. Mm-hmm. What has changed? You know, has it been easier to get sponsors? Have you changed your work, summer work, anything like that?
I mean, not really. I mean, I definitely have gotten a lot more people reaching out, a lot more fan base, a lot more. I mean, definitely a lot more individual sponsors. I'm not really huge into like going after big corporate sponsors and stuff. And sponsors take a lot of work. You know, I mean, they want something and they deservingly need something from you. And because of my lifestyle, I just don't have a lot of time to give to sponsors. You know, so I really focus on, you know, the social media aspect of things has been a huge deal for me. And, you know, I have a lot of individual dog sponsors and people that sponsor checkpoints and things like that. And that's just exploded. And one of the biggest changes is my sister has taken over a lot of my social media, like on Facebook. And she does a lot of my sponsorship thank yous. And she's doing a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, which I was like sort of halfway doing for the last 5 years, you know, like kind of getting it done when I absolutely had to. So that's been a big change, as my sister Melissa has stepped up. She lives in Ohio, but she's been a super fan of mine, you know, ever since I started mushing, and she knows me really well, and so she understands how to deal with me. And so that's always been a problem, is getting somebody to help you when you're just all over the place and hard to get a hold of and everything else. You just end up pissing people off. So with her, she knows what the deal is. She knows how busy I am, and she knows when to pick the times to get on me to do something and when not, and she can just grab the bull by the horns and do a lot of this stuff that needs to get done. So that's been a really big change. I think more than anything, I just have more confidence in general in the whole thing, you know, from my dog training. It's just kind of like, you know, I've won 3 quests before, you know, and that's awesome. And the quest is a really big deal, and it's my favorite race and always will be. But when you win the Iditarod, it is the top. It's the top of the food chain, you know. And I think the biggest change for me is that I came out of it going, you know what, the last 10 years, I did figure something out. I did learn from all those mistakes I've made over the years. And I have refined my training and my training program and for both me and the dogs. And so I have a lot more confidence. I had a lot more confidence just kind of going into this season, knowing that, like, yeah, what I'm doing works. And I just need to continue doing it.
That's really cool. And we all remember the epic battle of you and Dallas at the end there and keeping us on the edge of our seats. Dallas isn't doing it this year.
No.
And it's a smaller field in general. How do you feel about that? You know, just being a musher and sort of, you know, at the top of your game.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's a smaller field, but just like everything, things are going to ebb and flow. And I feel like, you know, we're at a stage, and I think the quest is seeing it too, is that a lot of the old guard have retired. And I think that's what you're seeing in the Iditarod. Everyone says, oh, the sport's in trouble and there's not a lot of mushers. But when you look at it, there's just a lot of guys that are getting old and retiring. And the fact of the matter is, I'm the old guy now. And I don't even know when that happened. I feel like I'm still that young buck out there trying to make it happen, you know. But in the end, I'm the old guy now. And so there's a changing of the guard going on. And I ran 5 mid-distance races this year. And, you know, 3 of the 5 were full, had tons of people, 25, 35 mushers, and a lot of names I've never heard, which means there's a lot of new folks coming up the road, you know, and whether they're handlers for other mushers or they're trying to build their own kennel like I did when I started, I feel like there's still a lot of potential with the sport. There's still plenty of people interested in the financial part of things. I think that plays a role this year, too, is everything is super expensive, you know.
And do you think that's just going to solve itself, or do you think the mushers or the organizations can do anything about that to help incentivize more?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they're going to have to a little bit, and I don't have the answers to that fully, but I feel like just the fact that they're making the races happen. I mean, the Iditarod and the Quest both had races all the way through COVID. And there were a lot of sporting events that just shut her down, right? And so the Iditarod powered through. Yeah, we lost some numbers and the purses aren't as high. But, I mean, look at the Quest. This is the highest purse they've ever had. And, I mean, that's something that's super positive, you know? And I hope other mushers will see that and be like, the Quest is doing everything it can to try and support its mushers. And, I mean, $40,000 for this race, that's for the winner. For me, that's huge. Like, that really helps in my financial stability, you know? It only still covers a portion of the dog food for the season, but, you know, we have other things going on that help make that money. But I feel like they just for me, I feel like the important part is that the races still happen. And if the races still happen, there will be mushers that sign up. There's going to be years when there's less mushers. And, you know, this is maybe one of them. But like I said, most of these mid-distance races did pretty well this year. I mean, we didn't have very many in the Quest. But when you look at it, there were 9 in each one of the big races. And there was 24, 25 in the 80. And that 80 was an amazing race. And all that is doing is nurturing younger mushers to become 300 mushers, and then to become 550 mushers, and then to become 1,000-mile mushers. And so the more of those smaller races we can put on, I think that was one of the greatest things the Yukon Quest did this year, is by having that other race that was kind of paired with all of us. And it gives them a sense of, like, being a part of the Yukon Quest and being a part of a race where there's champions and real big veterans that are in these races. I think it gives them a real spark and a hope that they can someday get to those races.
And just to give a sense of, you know, how you deal with the economic situation or the your finances, are you willing to share sort of like the breakdown of, you know, how much of your revenue comes from prize money versus sponsorships?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to, like, even think about prize money. You can't work prize. I mean, if you look at my track record in my racing career, if I based, you know, it's been a while now. I've been pretty steady for the last 5 years. But before that, you know, you could, if you based your finances on winning races or getting money from races, you'd be in trouble. Most of my stuff comes, I mean, I am a gold miner in the summertime. I generally work for a mine out in Eureka. And then on top of that, I do expeditions in April. That's my biggest source of income. So as soon as Iditarod's over, I go right into touring mode. And I have 3 big expeditions planned up in the Arctic this year. So I'll go right into that after Iditarod. And that's my big moneymaker. That's how I sustain. That's how the dogs basically pay their way. All my dog food and everything. My kennel is supported by my expeditions in April. So when I do well in the races like this, it just leads to financial stability, which most mushers don't have very much of that. So the race winnings are kind of the bonus. You know, it's like the bonus somebody gets for having a job and doing really good. They get a bonus, and that's a bonus on top of their salary. And for me, yeah, that's kind of what that is. I also have a lot of sponsors. You know, I don't have a lot of big sponsors. I don't have any, like, $40,000 sponsors, some big oil company or anything like that. But I have a dog sponsorship program every year that raises up to $30,000, and it's just individual people sponsoring a dog. And then that's the driving force for me to continue posting on social media and keep all the fans involved, because all those people are supporting me in their way, from $25 booty sponsorship all the way to a $500 sponsorship for an individual dog that then they call their own. You know, I crossed the finish line this year in the 550, and someone's standing there going, where's Marty, you know? And I'm like, oh, you're, because she had emailed earlier in the week and asking if she could come say hi to Marty after the race, and she's his sponsor, and she was there to say hi to him, and she follows along all the season, and, you know, and that $500 goes a long way for me. And so if I continue to post and give people that interactive feel of being a part of the team, that creates $30,000 for me every year, which is huge, you know, which is huge.
Gotcha. This is, I don't know if this is related, I guess, but I'm curious if you ever get any critics reaching out to you from the animal rights community, and do you think that is affecting at all the sport, and also how do you respond to those people?
You know, I don't, and I can't explain to you why, because I know that a lot of mushers do, but I don't. I mean, PETA says I'm the top dog abuser or something like that, you know, but, like, they're never targeting me. They're just plastering that on some web page that only PETA people read. I am, knock on wood, I am unaffected by it. And I think part of it is that you go to my social media, it's hard to pick on what we're doing. I mean, the dogs are happy. They're living their dream. They're you know, we're very well cared for. They're all the dogs, you know, are, they're just always happy. And so how can they attack us if they look at that and see positive, happy things happening all the time? And I feel like that has been, you know, the people that don't maybe post as much and are a little bit more in under the scenes, if something happens to them out there, they're a bigger target because they don't have all this positive stuff just floating around in the interwebs. Whereas for me, you can attack me, but then if anyone does any kind of research, you look into it, and it's, there's not very much that you can really attack that's public and visible. There isn't anything behind the scenes either. But yeah, so I've been really lucky, and I will say, like, I don't get attacked, and you know, there's some people that will post, oh, this is cruel to, you know, a post on social media or something, but it's an outlier. And the second they do that, my fans jump on them like it's, you know, it's like they get attacked by,
like,
the fans.
A pack of dogs.
Yeah, I got a pack of dogs. It's after those people immediately, because I have such a big following that are all behind me. And so I feel like PETA's always going to be there. The haters are always going to be there, just like in any sport, anything. There's always people that disagree with something you're doing. I think all we can do is keep it positive, do well by our dogs, continue, you know, treating them properly, and going out and showing people that we're treating them properly, and showing people how much these dogs love this sport and love to run. You can't deny it. I mean, if you've followed enough races, you can't deny that these dogs love what they're doing. And so as long as we're out there promoting the sport in a positive way, they can say whatever they want. They've been saying it for a long time, and they haven't taken us down yet. And I don't think that is going to be a problem going forward either.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, maybe we'll end on just a easy softball question, but what are you excited about for either the Iditarod or just, you know, the next few months of your dog sled month?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited about Iditarod. It'll be great to get back out there on the trail. I'm really excited to see who steps up. I mean, clearly I'm the one with the big X on my back. I'm the one with the target on my back. And after last year's battle with Dallas, and we were so far ahead of everybody else, but every year somebody comes up. I mean, I was that guy. I came up finally and challenged Dallas after him not being challenged for a lot of years. So somebody's going to step up. I mean, there's a bunch of guys that are already there. Pete Kaiser. I mean, you got Wade and Nick here. They're both, you know, they just finished this race, and their dogs did the same thing I just did. So they're primed and ready to go for Iditarod. And so I'm excited to see who steps it up and who you know, or who runs me over. You never know. Every race is different. And then I really look forward to my Arctic expeditions. I mean, everyone asks, how do you get off Iditarod and go do that? And well, one, I got to be able to support the kennel. And two, I just love doing it. And you know, as much as it's stressful being a guide and doing all that stuff, it's way less stressful for me when the races are over. And all of that, like everything that I trained for all season long, when we get done with those races, it's a big, big relief. And then I kind of go into the fun stuff where I'm just guiding people around, and people that want to be there, love to be there, and I'm sharing the sport of dog mushing with them, and I think that only helps the sport grow more popular and get a brighter light, just because you get somebody on the back of that dog sled, and then they get to feel what it's really like to be pulled around by these dogs. So yeah, I'm excited about everything going forward.
Reigning Iditarod champ Brent Sass there, talking to our reporter Lex Trinan before the Iditarod and after Sass's win in the Yukon Quest 550 in this bonus episode of the Iditapod. Stay tuned for another full episode of the Iditapod. Until then, I'm your host, Casey Grove. Happy trails.